The following program is pre-recorded. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show. Have a very interesting show for you tonight. We're going to deal basically with UFO crash information, witnesses and investigators who have investigated UFO crashes over the years. So stay tuned for that. But first, I want to talk to you a little bit more about our continuing MUFON saga. If you remember, we recently did an interview with their star team leader of the operation, and it looks like no longer is she there. Wait, now before you jump to any conclusions, I want to read you some information, a couple of emails from interested parties. The leader of the star team at the time when we interviewed her was Chase Klotsky. And she's no longer the MUFON star team manager. I got this note from Clifford Cliff, the international director. Larry Gessler has stepped up to the position. Chase did an outstanding job and will be missed. She is a very, very special person. MUFON owes her much. Larry will do a great job, and MUFON is pleased that he is willing to step in. End of quote from Clifford Cliff. Chase Klotsky replied to my query about all of this, and let me read it. I was so concerned, Jerry, that this would be identified with the other drama that's been going on with MUFON about my leaving MUFON. It had absolutely nothing to do with that craziness. Cliff is an extraordinary man with a heart the size of Texas. My only wish was to work with him and the field investigators longer. They are all the heart and soul of MUFON. This organization is strong and will continue doing the mission, fulfilling the mission statement that remains the beacon of serious UFO and truth-seeking. Thank you, Jerry, for seeking truth and being the voice of reason and professionalism. You are the best. Thanks, Chase. Well, I couldn't resist not reading that. The former international director of MUFON, James Carrion, is continuing in his unrelenting attacks on Clifford Cliff, the present international director, and also on the board of MUFON itself. I have come to a conclusion about Carrion, a personal conclusion. I've decided that maybe he's the troublemaker. Now, with that said, I know that he has some reasons to be disgusted, and he feels that he was not done properly or dealt with properly at MUFON, and that was one of the reasons he left. And we have given him a forum on our shows, and we have it. If you haven't heard it, the interview with James Carrion, very interesting. It's on demand at jerrypippin.com under our MUFON section. In that interview, Carrion made it clear that he felt that he had been done wrong by the board. And he also talked about his relationship with Robert Bigelow. But I often wonder now, why not, James, just move on? Instead, it seems that this constant attacks is actually doing nothing but destroying the credibility of a 40-year-old organization. If there is government interference, Carrion should name who he thinks is doing it. He says that he knows there's a mole on the board. He needs to come public. We're always open for James to come on the show, and he knows that. And we always give him a forum to talk. If he has something worthy and news worthy, we'll of course put him back on. Personally, I want to get past this he said, she said the confrontations have moved on. As far as I'm concerned, MUFON is actually moving back in the direction of scientific investigations of UFO sighting. Now, rest assured, we'll stay on top of all of the developments at MUFON. But as far as I can tell, the only agent provocateur at this point is Carrion, and maybe a couple of the state directors, like Ken Cherry. all of a sudden, these actions by Carrion seem very puzzling. Suspicious, really. Reminds me of something else that's going on that's very dear to my heart, and that's Roswell, where the Roswell Museum Director, Julie Schuessler, has done, in my opinion, great harm to the cause of the Roswell 1947 crash, even though her father was one of the founders of the museum. Seems that she's done everything within her power to muddy the waters and cause confusion in Roswell. Now, this has been going on for several years. She's had a cat fight with Rene Roach, who was in charge of the city's efforts to publicize the 1947 UFO crash with their annual anniversary. And as far as I could tell, the UFO Museum refused to work with the city. Not the other way around. Now the city has decided to reward her for her efforts. And her efforts are pretty strange. She used to keep guests from coming on my shows just because I was broadcasting from the city, even though the UFO Museum could not afford to pay our production fees or didn't want to or something. It seems to me they could have actually worked very well together, the city and the UFO Museum. Instead of lemonade, it's sour lemons. And now the Roswell UFO Museum is going to get at least most of the $150,000 stipend from the tourism tax, the lodging tax, even though there is now a new organization of UFO-related merchants in Roswell that are going before the Board of Supervisors or the appropriate board. I don't have it in front of me. But tomorrow to ask for their share of the receipts, because they want to have speakers this year for free. Paula Harris has indicated she may actually show up at the UFO merchants little conclave they're going to be doing. As far as I know, they're not going to charge. A Hall of Fame, that's another question. Julie's father was going to be inducted into the Roswell Hall of Fame and Walter Hout, and Julie objected. This money from the lodging tax is actually to promote Roswell. And our shows on Roswell at jerrypippin.com over the years have been well received not only in this country but everywhere. 8% of the audience, believe it or not, is in China. So anyway, the group of UFO small merchants in Roswell now are going to go head-to-head against the UFO Museum. So if you're planning on going to Roswell this summer, and I would urge you to go to the anniversary regardless of who does it, please, please go to the UFO Museum. Please, please, however, go on to all of the small UFO businessmen, the UFO merchants in Roswell. They appreciate your business. We'll be giving you more information on their plans, including the lectures of several people who they are talking about coming down to Roswell and actually doing free lectures. Interestingly enough, Paula Harris has never been welcomed, to my knowledge, at the UFO Museum. She's a great reporter. She has a great story about a UFO landing, a crash that happened in 1945, almost 2 years before the Roswell crash, and happened in New Mexico at the edge of the White Sands Missile Range and a little town called San Antonio, New Mexico. We have that show available, and I would urge you to go listen to it if you haven't. But it seems to me that the agent provocateurs here are James Carrion, the former international director of MUFON, and Julie Schuessler, the director of the UFO Museum. Now, do I know if there are indeed agent provocateurs or moles from the secret alphabet agencies of the U.S. government? No, I don't. I'm not sure why the U.S. government be spending all those assets for that. It seems to me that it's well past 60 years, and... You know, how long you want to keep a secret? What's the big deal? Well, you and I know what the big deal is. All the back engineering was developed for technology's purposes, and corporations made a lot of money, not only from the military, but also with commercial applications.
So perhaps with all of the arguments in the political arena about budget shortfalls, perhaps we need to use some of those profits the corporations made off of the Defense Department when they gave them the rights to back engineer everything.
Got several emails about this MUFON thing. Tom Fox wrote me. He says, anyone know why Peter Davenport started NUFARC instead of going with MUFON? Anyway, Tom was asking about that. And Bruce McAbee said, actually, that their organization that Peter Davenport is head of now was actually started by somebody else. I think he's right. And if MUFON's worried about what's happening, I don't think so. It seems to me that there's been a drifting of MUFON and its membership into more esoteric areas of ufology, even, you know, high strangeness such as ghost investigations, things like that. Things are pretty far away from the original scientific goal of MUFON. And I have nothing against that. Spirituality is also, you know, pretty rampant. And people are welcome to believe what they want to. And these organizations shouldn't be telling them what to do. But I think, basically, if they want to spend a lot of MUFON investigation time on these subjects, maybe they don't need to be in MUFON. I'm even having questions about why MUFON's investigating abductions. So from a standpoint, my standpoint at least, it's for MUFON is to get back to scientific investigations of UFOs and UFO crash retrievals. Speaking of UFO crash retrievals, we have an interesting interview here that we've not played on our weekly show, but it is available on demand at jerrypippin.com under our Roswell section. Art McCurdy was the editor of the afternoon newspaper in Roswell in 1947. And Art, by the way, was also good friends with Colonel Joe Blanchard, in charge of the Roswell Air Base, Army Air Base at the time. And basically, Art McCurdy, in this interview, tells me about that relationship and how Colonel Blanchard admitted, or almost admitted, that there was something really strange happening in July of 1947. So we're going to play that interview. It was recorded in Roswell at our booth at the convention center. So let's listen. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Roswell. We are at the convention center, and we have a 91-year-old man here who actually is not old at all, Art McQuitty. Welcome to the show.
The 7th of July in 1947, I was editor of the morning newspaper, the Roswell Morning Dispatch. We had a small paper, but nevertheless, we were out 6 days a week, and I've often laughed and said Roswell back in after World War II was a fanatic baseball town. The men of the town just loved professional baseball, followed it religiously, so that was our excuse for being a newspaper. I ran the box scores on the front page of the dispatch every day because the guy's radio wasn't even that good right after the war. Mm-hmm. And so the guys wanted to know what happened in the baseball games. Mm-hmm. They had a circulation of about 5,000 then, an old flatbed press that was 50 years old and sheet-fed and and the hot metal shop, and obviously. But so it was pretty quiet, and then about 11 o'clock that morning, Walter Hawk, the public information officer at the base, or PR guy at the base, brought a two-paragraph press release in, and basically, it, and I don't remember it because, well, anyway, it said basically that wreckage of an unidentified flying object had been found on a ranch 45 miles north of Roswell, and it had been brought into the Walker Air Force Base. What happened, 2 nights before the 7th, there was a giant electrical storm north of town. We had one just the other night here, as a matter of fact. And it was put on a good show for a while. Mm-hmm. And this old sheepherder who was up on the ranch up there, wasn't his ranch, he was just literally, but nevertheless, well, a decent man. Mm-hmm. He was used to thunder and lightning, but there was a particularly loud explosion, and it didn't. He just assumed it was part of the electric storm. But the next day, when he went out in the pasture, he began to pick up pieces of something he'd never seen before. Well, obviously, that was on the 5th of July. It was on the 6th that he started picking up this stuff. And I don't know how much of it he took. None of us ever got a chance to see the wreckage, except Jesse Marcells, the intelligence officer at the base. And I don't know what they called him back in those days in the Army Air Corps. But he took it over and showed it to his neighbors 3 or 4 miles away, maybe 5 miles away. And they said, you ought to take this in and take it to the sheriff because this could be something that somebody might be interested in. And I'm paraphrasing. I don't know what they advised him to take it into George Wilcox, the sheriff. And he didn't get around to it till that afternoon on July. No, he got it around to it that afternoon of July the 6th. And the sheriff called the Army Airfield. So I
guess that's how Jesse Marcell got involved.
So he came in kind of after work to pick this stuff up, and the story that we had, that the stuff he had were pieces of what looked like aluminum foil, but they were, as near as I could tell, the pieces he had were in a box. I mean, you know, like so. Well, he took the box home that night, and he's a little boy. Played with the stuff, and they took a cigarette lighter and tried to light it, and it wouldn't burn, and you could crimp it, and it would stamp right back. And so he assumed they had something, that it was off of a crash site out 45 miles north of Roswell, and perhaps it was, I don't know whether he ever related it to an unidentified flying object or not, after he got it from the sheriff, but he didn't take it out to the base till the next morning, and when they started looking at it out there, they said, "Well, this has got to be considering this, how it happened, the explosion or the thunderclap. This got to be wreckage of an unidentified flying object, maybe." I don't know whether he had seen anything or not. I just don't know. But Walter Hawk was the base publicity director, whatever they called him. Anyway, Walter and Butch Blanchard, the commanding colonel out at the base, put together this little two-paragraph press release. Well, we had two radio stations in Roswell and the two newspapers, And I was the morning paper, so I always got the press releases from the Army Air Base last, because I didn't go to press till 12 o'clock at night. Well, an awful lot of the good news stories broke around 5 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. So you had more stories.
Well, we got them, although, and that's another one I could talk for a half an hour about my fight with the Associated Press.
Yeah.
And the general manager of the AP in Dallas, I said, the governor of Texas can go to the bathroom, we'll get 5 inches. If the president can get shot, and we'll get a paragraph from those guys over in Dallas. I was always fighting with them. But anyway, Walter had a good friend who was a part owner and an announcer on the new radio station, so he took the press release to him first. And this guy was not any dummy. He immediately called the Associated Press in Albuquerque, and they put it on the international radio, on the national radio.
You're right.
And I started getting telephone calls before I'd even gotten the press release. Walter finally got around to me about 11 o'clock. But it was a very exciting news day for me, because I talked to all three of the daily papers in London. I talked to Paris Match. I talked to... I don't remember all of them now, but I spent pretty much the whole day answering the phone. If calls were coming from all over the world, and I thought about it later, and I realized that even though that was 1947, the Cold War was beginning to heat up a little bit, and people were worried to death about what was going on between the Soviets and the Americans. And... Plus the fact that there had been multiple sightings of flying saucers reported, mostly out of the United States, but in other countries as well. So people were thinking about these things, and so when the word came out that wreckage of one had been found in this little small city in New Mexico, It triggered an awful lot of excitement
around the world.
Around the world, Walter called me. That called all four of us about 1 o'clock that afternoon. And he said, "Don't throw that press release away. I got to come pick it up because that wasn't wreckage of a flying saucer at all. It was the remains of a weather balloon." And I had been a Navy pilot for 4 years in the Pacific, and we didn't spend much time with $25 weather balloons, yeah. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
And we just flew when we had to. But I didn't know I didn't have any idea really what it was. But I'll try to talk fast. I don't want to take up your time. But... But the story was a gigantic story the day it broke, and it was the next day it was a dead story. It was the darndest phenomenon in newspapering for me because it was exciting, and then it was dead. And what I know happened.
Yeah.
And the rest is conjecture on my part, because I'm kind of an amateur astronomer, and we darn near find a new thing out in space every week, it seems like.
We're talking with Art McQuinty, who was the editor of the newspaper in 1947 and was there when the UFO incident happened here in Roswell. But Art, you were more than just a newsman. You became friends with quite a few of these people, including Colonel Blanchard, right?
He was a very close friend of mine, and I'll just relate briefly. I flew PBYs in the Navy, a twin-engine amphibious bomber.
Yes, I know.
And by the end, by middle of 1945, we were doing almost exclusively air-sea rescue. My squadron had been on Midway, and one of our guys had been one of the fellows that found the Japanese fleet during on the 5th of May in 1942 when they had the big fight.
Yeah, right.
And I think it was the battle that changed the whole war because we sank three of their carriers. But I wasn't there, but my squadron was out there. And so I was five of us, five crews, five planes. We were sent up to Iwo Jima, and we were doing air sea rescue of the B-29s to Japan. And people don't realize those B-29s were getting shot down, too. We were down on Guam, I'll never forget it, in a Quonset, a big Quonset hut, and Curtis LeMay was there. He was commanding general of SAC. I don't know whether they call it SAC then or not, but later SAC. And he got up at the podium and said, and this was early when the B-29s had just really started coming to Saipan and Tinian. He said, "You've been bombing at 30,000 feet and you can't even hit Japan. From this day on, you're not going to go above 5,000 feet. And I want you to do a decent bombing job. And if some of you get shot down, this is a war." And that's darn near verbatim what he said. He was a tough guy, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. So we were numboing the guys up to, and goodness, by that time we had one of us at 100 miles, one of us at 200, a destroyer at 300, a submarine in Tokyo Bay. If the guys got their engines shot out, if they could get out and get away from Japan, we had a pretty darn good chance to save them. And in the course of that, I had saved, I don't say saved, but I had found guys that had to ditch. And one of them, particularly close to Chichijima, which worried all of us, we had to circle him all night because we couldn't land and pick him up. The weather was bad, and there was the closest destroyer was going to take him about 8 hours to get over to pick him up. But this created, helped make my friendship with Butch Blanchard a really good friendship, and plus the fact that he was a delightful guy and I liked him a lot, and being an old Navy pilot, I mean, you know, and weeks later, seems like weeks, it probably was not even a month, he and I were in the bar of the officers club late one night. You know all these stories. And every time we were together, I said, "Come on, Butch, now tell me what really happened." I said, I know about the nurse and Glenn Dennis, and I know about the 100 guys that went out there and walked through the pasture, and I know that you closed the highway between Vaughan and Rossel for 2 days, I said, "I know all about those things." He said, "I don't talk about that." But that night he said, "Well, I'll tell you this. I saw something I've never seen before, and I hope I never see again." Mm-hmm. Well, I sobered up in a minute. You know, I was really...
You had a story, obviously.
I thought I did. he said, "I shouldn't have said that. I'm not supposed to talk about any of that." And he said, I got my ass in a...
Was talking about the press release, right? I mean... well, he might have got in trouble there, but he was able to go on up the ladder and become a four-star general before he passed away.
Admit that, but he never would talk about it. And it's hard to keep track of in a time period like that. But later, there was a story in the New York Times, a national story. He had been in Moscow, Russia, and had gotten into a drinking contest with some Russian pilots, and he said he could outdrink them, and he did. He drank about a gallon of vodka or something, according to this story. And I thought to myself, that's Blanchard if I ever knew him. He was a delightful guy.
Yeah, and you guys called him Butch, right? I
mean, yeah, well, his name was Bill, but he was kind of, you know, short haircut and all that, and he'd been skipper of the 509th, I guess, and I'd saved some of the... Some of the crews I saved were from the 509th. And
you have anyone else talk to you about it?
Well, not really.
Not on the record, of course.
Nobody would even talk to me. And I I didn't pursue it that diligently because they say the story died so fast. But I don't know. Glenn Dennis now is pretty ill, so I doubt that you. I don't know whether you may.
Oh, I know Glenn.
Yeah. Well, if you know Glenn, you know the kind of person he is.
Yes.
And nobody that was involved in any of this after Glow made any money out of it. I mean, there wasn't any con jobs going on or guys coming in saying, yeah, I saw one. They got out and they shook hands with me. There was no lying going on as far as I know. And I love Glenn's story, you know, goodness sakes.
He always stuck with that story, too.
Well, it was a true story.
Yeah.
He's sitting down there at the funeral home, and the nurse he's been going with calls and asks if they have children's caskets. And he said, I don't know. I'll go up in the attic and see. And he said, I'll call you back. And she said, no, Glenn, I'm on a phone where you can't call me back. She said, I'll just hold. He came back and he said, well, we have three children's caskets. And she said, well, bring them out, but don't take them to the hospital. She said, I'm in another building, and when you get here, if I'm not out there, just put them on the grass and get away as fast as you can. You don't want to be involved in any of this. He didn't know what she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Glenn.
Yeah.
None of us, and you know about as much as I know anyway, but none of us had any reason to try to amplify it or make something out of it. It just wasn't that kind of...
Did you know the nurse?
No, I had never met her.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know Glenn that well then. I later was married to a Roswell girl. She and Glenn were in the same class in high school, and he and I did become good friends, and... He was quite a talented sculptor. He made miniature sculpts like Raj Assen over at the museum, and he had a very good farm
Were you still in Roswell when they opened up that museum, or you'd already?
Well, I would.
I know you got out of journalism later and got a real job.
Yeah, I got a real job. And.
Just teasing. I've been in this field all my life.
We were married in 1949, and we moved to Los Angeles in 1950, and I went into a new field called public relations. You know, like probably called corporate publicity for years of it, but basically, it was a new kind of corporate field and a kind of. Government information field they were looking for how I got into it. Jack Campbell, who was later governor of the state, came by the dispatch office one day and said, I knew Jack casually. He was in a good law firm here, Atwood Malone and Campbell. And Ross Malone, again, I'm digesting to divert. Ross Malone was later vice president and general counsel of General Motors, and the youngest president of the American Bar Association they've ever had. And here he is, a Roswell lawyer and a delightful guy. And Jack said, anyway, he said, I'm running the Oil and Gas Association here, and he said, I'm going back to private law practice, and the association is looking for what they call public relations, and they're trying to hire newspaper editors to do it. Would you be interested in the job? And I said, well, how much does it pay?
Right.
Getting ready to get married, so I left the paper became secretary of the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, which basically, fundamentally, the job was lobbying in the legislature. And at that time, you didn't have to have a pass or anything. There were only three of us.
Yeah, you could just go see anybody, right?
Yeah, well, the three of us that were lobbyists, the vice president of Kennecott Copper from Silver City was their lobbyist. And then the Nature Pass had a lobbyist, and that we were it. So,
Art, you were an eyewitness to history back in 1947, and you've had plenty of time to think about it. You really believe something happened out there. I mean, an E.T., a flying saucer.
As we talked about this around town after the fact, Barbara and Bob Anderson, our local billionaire, they stopped their car coming back from Santa Fe one day and watched the flying saucer. And another oil man, Bert Murphy, and his wife Martha, very, very dependable people. He had his own little private plane. They were coming back from Artesia and stopped twice to look at sea flying saucers. And probably the most conservative guy in Roswell was owned a hardware store, Wilmot Hardware Store, and Hinton Wilmot was rocking on his front porch and saw a flying saucer.
So they were around.
Well, reputable people were so people. You know, Bob Anderson spent his life in an airplane after he was chairman of Atlantic Richfield, and I've never talked to Barbara about it, but. He told me about it once, and such as it was, but it was I just happen to believe that it's
you're convinced it's real, right?
Periodically, you'll see a little squib. Now, as recent as sometime last year, they had multiple sightings down off of Perth, Australia. Well, that's the end of the world. If you know where Perth is, I mean, God, it
makes Roswell look like a real urban area.
Well, it makes Roswell. They're just way down on the other side of Australia all by themselves. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be a bad place to be. As a matter of fact, Roswell's not a bad place. Basically, that's what little I know about it. But we had a secretary or vice president, chairman of the paid employee of the Roswell Chamber of Commerce, and he had been out at the base, enlisted man, and he was one of the 100 that they took up and walked through the pasture home. And he said had their arms linked together, so looking for more wreckage, and
so that's a lot of effort to look for a weather.
Well, there was then a lot of efforts to look for a damn $25 weather.
And I think with that, we'll leave thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
A Jerry Pippin special report. Chemtrails, a project from hell. Sometime in the late 70s, it became apparent that the high-flying contrails of superjets crossing the sky was much more than just a romantic reminder that we were deep in the heart of the jet age. These contrails were lasting longer, and they seemed to be crisscrossing each other. We have decided to do this investigative series on this phenomenon. And it appears that there is something sinister going on. But why?
And I talked to my NSA buddies at Fort Carson, Peterson Air Force Base, Buckley, where I was actually their doctor taking care of the pilots flying and spraying the chemtrails. So I know it's real. If anybody says it's not real, they're full of it.
It seems to be apparent from looking at the patents for aerospraying and for using nanoparticles to put into the atmosphere. These particles seem to be made of aluminum, barium, and other elements. There's even evidence that it's in jet fuel itself, not as a byproduct, but put there evidently to aid in this worldwide effort of covering the skies with what we know now as chemtrails.
Well, many of the planes that we're seeing here in Abilene will actually turn whatever they're spraying on and off right before our eyes. I mean, you'll see a plane up there flying like normal, and then all of a sudden it starts spraying. We've seen them fly off into the distance and then loop around and fly back again. These are not your typical planes with a preordained path destination from city to city. Someone needs to explain to me why do they stop traveling in one particular direction and then loop around and come back again. They perform this behavior so many times that we start seeing the tic-tac-toe grids in the sky. We're witnessing the giant X's.
The FAA at one time said it was acid rain. They were combating acid rain.
Yes, the FAA has acknowledged that something is going on in the skies. Our investigation shows that there are specially fitted aircraft. For 30 years, this has been happening with these aircraft. They've been fitted, and they've been flying. And all this costs money. So who is paying for it? And why? What kind of public money is being used? And who's getting the income? Is it really necessary? And is this threat real? Or is it only a way for these corporations to make a lot of money? There may be many agendas here. All are coming into play. Seems to be a perfect storm, benefiting certain groups. Seems that the chemical industry has been working for some time on specially developed plants. They're hybrids, half nature, half chemical. Think of the money that could be made if Mother Nature's seeds no longer worked in the chemically changed compounds that have been dropped onto the soil. Agribusiness should not be discounted at all as one of the culprits. The potential of huge profits is certainly there, and it's worldwide, and chemtrails are seen everywhere around the globe. There is a trail, a paper trail, of what was done before. But why is it so guarded securely by such regulators as EPA, air and water quality control experts, as well as the oversight of the FAA itself, NOAA, NASA, and the United States Air Force? The list goes on and on. There's lots of oversight into our laws, but are these laws being circumvented? We will be examining all of these issues with several guests in this series.
That series is underway right now, by the way, and you can check it out at jerrypippin.com. Get to it from the highlights window on the homepage, or you can go to iPodShows.net. We'll be adding more and more shows to this series, so check it out. All this week, a new program, each night, as we examine chemtrails. Let's get back to the UFO business and the crash retrieval business. We have an interesting guest here I want to bring on. It was recorded in Las Vegas with Anna Antonio Humanis. He spent 3 decades investigating UFOs and is an official and a semi-official person when it comes to examining UFOs. He's done it both, officially and semi-officially. Who did he work for? Well, he worked for the U.S. government. Yeah, well, that was one of the employers. But he also worked for several other countries with his U.N. connections. Antonio was a key player in the Rockefeller Initiative, which we've heard a lot about. And here he tells us in this interview some things that were never reported before, such as the Soviet Union and South America and their UFO experiences. I think you'll find the interview interesting. We originally did this in Las Vegas at the Tuscany Hotel Suites on Flamingo when they had the crash retrieval conferences. That's one of the great conferences, and we miss it. Anyway, let's listen to Antonio. Welcome to the UFO Files. I'm Jerry Pippin. We've been at the Tuscany Suites Hotel, really relaxed. And of course, it's Las Vegas, so you have to say casino. And it's a nice place. And we're having a lot of fun at the 5th Annual Crash Retrieval Place. It's a fantastic conference, always one of my favorites. Ryan does a great job bringing all of these people together. And all of this show is brought to you by UFOTV.com, our sponsor. And our number is 1-800-350-4639. You want to write that down later if you want to order a special DVD or a conspiracy DVD. You know, UFOTV.com has the best selection of the genre, really. And we have an interesting man here who now lives in the Washington, D.C. area. And, you know, the interesting thing about Antonio is you're originally, what, from Chile?
Yeah, my family's from Chile. My father used to work at the United Nations. And I was born in New York.
You lived in New York, so you're a New York citizen, right? I'm an American citizen,
yes. Right. I call myself a Chilean-American because I got, you know, the dual citizenship, and also I have, culturally, I'm South American, but I actually have...
And you have an interesting last name, and why don't you pronounce it for me?
Huneus, which is not Spanish, would be more like of German origin, actually.
Well, that's the excuse I'm going to use on why I didn't introduce you properly, okay? Because all I say is, who knows, each time. But I was close.
You can call me Antonio. That would be easy.
Yeah, right. Antonio, you did basically here a presentation on South American UFO crashes and sightings.
Yeah, tomorrow I'm talking, actually.
And have you always been interested in UFOs?
For about 30 years.
Oh, really?
Yes. In
fact, what got you started?
I got started 30 years ago with a famous case in Chile of an abduction of an army patrol. It's known as the Corporal Valdez case. It's a very well-known case, especially in the South American...
Could you kind of briefly tell our listeners what happened there?
Yeah, it's a very unusual case. It happened on the Atacama Desert near the border with Bolivia. And it was on April 25th, 1977, and you had a patrol of seven soldiers and a corporal. And they were camping on a site there in the desert, and it was in the early hours of the morning, around, let's say, 4 a.m. or something like that, when the soldier who was on watch saw this huge light that seemed to be hovering or perhaps landing not far from the patrol. So he woke up, the leader, the corporal, and the rest of the soldiers. They all grabbed their guns and all that, and they walked towards the UFO. Valdez told the other soldiers that they should all stick together and not move. Yet, as he later explained, he heard like a voice inside his head that urged him to walk towards the UFO. So he did. He walked towards the UFO.
Now, did he go up by himself or with the rest?
No, just by himself.
Okay.
Because it was at night, it's not clear where the people literally saw him being snatched by the UFO. He just disappeared into the night as he walked towards the lights. And then he was missing. The soldiers were in panic, right? I mean, they have this huge object blinking right across them. Their leader is gone. And then here's where it comes a really bizarre part of the story. 15 minutes later, the corporal reappears, but they never saw him walk back from the UFO. He reappears behind the patrol.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And nobody was looking.
Nobody was looking. And he's kind of in a total state of shock. And he only says, muchachos, you know, boys, whatever, and he passes away. He vanishes for the moment. I mean, just, you know, lost his consciousness. But here's where the story became so famous. I don't know if you were in the army, but anybody that was in the military, you have to shave every day, right?
Yes.
You cannot be walking around without shaving.
That doesn't go over very well.
Right. When this guy returned from the soul, we have to assume that he had shaved the day before. When he came back from this experience, he had what they estimated about 4 or 5 days growth on his beard. Now, he had a wristwatch. The wristwatch had stopped after a half an hour, but the calendar on the wristwatch those that had the little date, the calendar marked 5 days in the future. So
he went in the future. Time
got compressed, but instead of being missing time, it was expanded time.
He
disappears for roughly half an hour of our time, but when he comes back, there's both a physiological effect on the growth of his beard and a mechanical effect on the watch. So it's a very strange case.
Did he explain what happened to him?
No, he had a total blank.
He
had no recollection. The story, this was in the early days of the Pinochet, you know, the military dictatorship.
Yes, right.
They controlled the press, everything back in those days. There was press censorship. Yet, this was also an ironic twist of the story. As the finally dawn came, the UFO took off. Then the patrol decides to go back into the regiment, you know, to report the incident to their superiors. And the first person they meet is a school teacher. His name is Pedro Araneda. And the school teacher happened to be interested in UFOs. This is in the middle of nowhere, right in the desert. And the one person they meet is a kind of a hobby, has a hobby of ufology. And he happened to have a tape recorder, and this man did a classic, a famous interview with the corporal and with all the soldiers, literally 1 hour after the incident. Now, when he went back to the nearest cities, and it's a port city in the border with close to the border with Peru and Bolivia, called Arica, and the newspapers of Arica got hold of the press of the tape. And it was going to be published. The military initially censored it, but there was such a fuss over the story. And since the story wasn't political, you know, at least in the traditional sense of politics, finally the military did relent on this case, and they allowed it to be published. And it made headlines all over the newspapers in Chile, front page on the main, El Mercurio, which is like the New York Times of Chile, was published everywhere. Well, my brother happened to send me the clippings of this incident. I was already in New York, and I saw a little alternative newspaper that was called the New York Daily Planet, which was published by a man called Mike Luckman, who became a famous ufologist and recently wrote a book called Alien Rock.
Right.
And about the rock and roll UFO connection. You know him. And so he published my story. He thought it was fascinating. And that was published on the July 4th edition of the New York Daily Planet in 1977, and that got my UFO career started.
Have you had some books published since then?
I have written hundreds of articles. I started first writing articles, also for some of the South American newspapers, but in English, for the... I caught the last wave of the old pulp UFO magazines, UFO Report and Ideals UFO Magazine and UFO Annual. Mm-hmm. I made it to the sort of the last issues of those magazines. Then they all went out of business in their early 80s. Later I wrote for another pulp magazine called UFO Universe, but eventually I became the UFO columnist in Fade magazine. And I kept that column going for about 10 years. I did publish two books. They're both out of print now. One is a study guide to UFOs, psychic and paranormal phenomena in the USSR. And this came around 1991, just before the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I was just the editor. It was basically a compilation of all kinds of articles mm-hmm. on all these subjects. From Russia, or still was called the Soviet Union. What happened is when, as you remember, when Gorbachev came in Glasnost, Soviet media had an opening, one of the subjects that they opened up, and really opened up in a big way, was UFOs. And I don't know if you remember that famous case of Voronezh, the landing in the park, where it was a bunch of school children were playing soccer, and they saw this large UFO land on a park.
Okay.
And it came, these robotic-type aliens came out of it. It made front page, even on the New York Times was front page. Made front page all over the world. It was released by the TASS news agency at the time. It was a huge story. Newsday in New York had like a huge headline, Close Encounters of the Soviet Kind.
Yeah, it was a good headline.
It was a great story.
Yeah.
And I had attended a symposium in Frankfurt in 1989, which was fabulous. It was put by Michael Hesseman, and the famous German ufologist. And they had people from all over the world. But for the first time ever, you had a huge delegation of Soviet ufologists, because up to that point, there was no contact. There was no internet in those days. You couldn't send emails to people over there. Right. They were under communism. There was no free exchange, you know, with the West. It was difficult. You could send things on the mail, but you never knew if they would get it or be censored or whatever. But now things were opening in a big way. And I met all these different Soviet ufologists, Bulantsev, Marina Popovich, many of them. I interviewed many of them, even though I don't speak Russian. But I had a friend from Tucson, no, from Phoenix, Arizona. Well, I had met him originally in New York, Dmitry Osipov. He was originally Serbian, but he was a polyglot. He spoke many languages.
Okay.
And he did a lot of the translations for me. So we put that book out. And then in the late 90s, I was involved. I was one of the co-authors of the famous, was part of the Rockefeller Initiative, you know, the UFO briefing document.
Mm-hmm.
It was a quite famous document that originally was a non-commercial report that was financed by Lawrence Rockefeller. It was co-written by Don Berliner, Marie Goldbraith, who was the coordinator. She had the, she was the one that had the connection with Rockefeller.
We're going to take a break, and I want to follow that up and ask you a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to more on your subject of South American UFOs,
sure,
too. But this Rockefeller Initiative has come up in several shows I've been doing. And
sure.
I want to get to your take on it.
Well, I was part of it. I did.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right. And I want to find out more
perhaps
about
I
it.
I have a little bit more insight than other people.
Antonio mentioned Fate Magazine, and guess what? That's our next commercial.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. Every month in Fate Magazine.
Fate.
Fate Magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest-running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. It's Jerry Pippin, and we are in Las Vegas at the Tuscany. And, of course, it's a UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, the fifth annual. And Antonio, go ahead and give me your last name again.
Who knows?
Yeah, I still think it's
Antonio Who Knows.
Tell me, you were part of this Rockefeller Initiative. Let's get into that. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, as you know, there were many aspects of the Rockefeller Initiative. It was a multi-pronged effort. And the first part, I had nothing to do. That's when Rockefeller and...
Now we're talking about Lawrence
Rockefeller. The late Lawrence Rockefeller, who was one of the grandsons of the original John D. Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, brother of Nelson, the vice president,
yeah,
and David, the banker. And these were the
right,
best known ones. Initially, Rockefeller and a lawyer called Diamond had a series of meetings with John Gibbons, who was the White House science advisor for the Clinton administration. And this was the earlier part of the Rockefeller Initiative, but that was pursued directly by Rockefeller and the White House. Then came a second aspect of the initiative, and that was done through Marie Goldbraith. Marie Goldbraith was the wife of the former ambassador of the United States to France under Ronald Reagan. Just to give you an idea of the, okay, this is not your run-of-the-mill ufologist, right?
Right, gotcha.
And her husband, Evan Goldbraith, had been a candidate for governor in New York State, and obviously was a man of the banking world and international politics and diplomacy. Although he wasn't interested in the subject at all, as far as I know. But his wife certainly was. And so she had a connection with Rockefeller, and that's how the funding and all that was coming through her. And we actually had an office and everything in Madison Avenue. And the original report had been commissioned to Don Berliner from the Fund for UFO Research in Washington, D.C., who was an old aviation journalist who was a member of the old NICAP group, you know, under Major
right,
Kehoe and
mm-hmm,
all that. And he actually conceived the original format of the briefing document and wrote the original draft. But Marie Galbraith and other people associated with this project thought that it needed to be updated, really. And also it needed far more international aspect. And so that's where I was brought in as an international science journalist who had done many, who was very familiar with all the foreign aspects of ufology. I speak Spanish, of course. I also know French because I studied French at the Sorbonne University many, many years ago.
Well, that's a good credit.
So basically my job was to improve the document. And we expanded it quite a bit. We added cases from Russia, from Canada, from Spain, and even the cases that dealt with Belgium and France, which were originally in the document, but they were not based on primary sources. So I rewrote those too. And we also obtained the cooperation directly of the agencies, like on the French cases. And Marie Galbraith, who of course had been the ambassador's wife in France, she knew all the officials in France. We contact directly the official UFO study group at the French Space Agency, and they send us all the reports, especially for the famous Trans-en-Provence landing case, you know, which is a very significant incident that took place in 1981, where a UFO landed at a farm in southern France. And the biological samples of the leaves where the UFO landed were analyzed by a number of laboratories, and this was all conducted officially by the French government, and a number of interesting, very weird, bizarre results were found. For instance, one of the most interesting results was that the plants, was alfalfa plants, the plants were young, physiologically speaking. But after the incident where this UFO landed over this field, they aged biochemically. And the scientists from the French Space Agency said there's nothing in nature that can explain this. The chlorophyll from the plants were gone, and so on. So we obtained all the official reports, which now you can download from the Internet, because now the French Space Agency...
Made at least a move toward openness.
But back in those days, it wasn't so easy to obtain some of these reports. Right. And we also were in touch with General de Bruvier, who was the number three man of the Belgian Air Force, who had been involved in the famous Belgian wave of the early 90s. And this is where it helped to have someone like Marie Galbraith. I remember working at her office. And I suggested, well, why don't we call the general, you know, to see if we needed some additional information about that famous incident where they scrambled the F-16s. Well, she called the Ministry of Defense in Brussels. She reached the office of the general. She says, is General de Bruvier there? Well, no, he's busy. Who's calling? Marie Galbraith. Within less than 5 minutes, the general was on the phone. Oh, chère madame, you know. Yeah. Yeah. If I had called, they would have given me the time of the day. You know?
Too bad, Antonio.
Right. So anyway, it was an exciting period. And just to wrap up the Rockefeller thing, then there was a third final phase of the Rockefeller initiative, which I was not involved, and that was the Sturrock Report. This was a scientific committee that was financed by Rockefeller and coordinated by an astrophysicist from the University of Stanford University in California, in which they brought a panel of scientists, mostly from Europe. These were what I would call neutral scientists. In other words, they were not involved in ufology, but they were not debunkers. They were not skeptics.
Right.
They were scientists, you know. I mean, show me the evidence, but I have an open mind. And then they brought another group of scientists, and these were scientists within the UFO community, people like John Schussler, Richard Haynes, Bruce McAbee, and so on, included Jean-Jacques Velasco, the man from the space agency from France. And then these people presented to the panel the best cases on radar, on landing cases, on photographic evidence, and so on. And finally, to see if they could convince the panel, you know, that this was a worthwhile phenomena. And the scientists, being very cautious and all that, they didn't say, well, aliens are invading or anything like that. But they did say, yes, what we have been shown is sufficient evidence that merits a serious scientific investigation. So that basically
the reason I wanted to find out, and this is really great that you were involved that deeply in it. A lot of people say, well, they expected a lot from the White House on that, and it didn't seem to happen.
Well, what happened with the White House is the thing was diffused by the Air Force report. Because when the Rockefeller and the lawyer Diamond were, and at that time there was a fellow called Scott Jones from the Human Potential Foundation in Washington, D.C. area, who Rockefeller was financing, who coordinated some of these things. And at that, this was before the Air Force report on Roswell and before the General Accounting Office report and all that. And so the way this was diffused is the White House said, well, but you know that now we've the Air Force will now release everything they have on Roswell. Of course, at that time we didn't know that that was going to be the Mogul balloon report and all that. That came later. So it looked for some achievement had been done. You know that now there was going to be an official investigation of Roswell, but then of course we later find out what that was all about.
It seems to me that there were people in that Clinton administration that were interested in UFOs and getting the truth out, and then all of a sudden they're part of the whitewash.
Well, there was one of the people in the Clinton administration who is involved now. John Podesta. So something came up, at least, although I imagine that he's more as a hired gun, you know. He's being hired as a lawyer. I don't think he's doing it because he's just personally interested in it, although I don't know. I haven't met him. But
I don't know.
But he certainly is interesting to have someone of the caliber of John Podesta, pursuing this and suing the government for documents and all that.
Well, how did the people connected with this Rockefeller report? Did they feel like they were successful, or do you feel like you were successful, or
only up to a point? I felt that our report was good and it was a good effort, but unfortunately, and it was sent to a number of important people. It was sent to members of Congress and VIPs worldwide. Even people like Billy Graham got a copy.
Oh, really? Yes. Did you get a reaction from him?
Well, I don't know, because that was sent by Mr. Rockefeller himself.
Okay.
but I do know that people at that level, too, you know, received it. But the problem of the Rockefeller Initiative is that whereas the compilation of the report had been very systematic, and a lot of money was put, you know, to amass all the documentation and to edit it and to produce this report, there was no plan for the release. I mean, something like this, you need a lobbying effort, you know, something like that Steve Bassett is doing or something like that. There has to be a lobbying organ or a public relations company
PR company that's in with the media that they would pay attention
to. And instead there was absolutely nothing. There was like a void. However, nevertheless, I can think of at least two instances where our report did have an impact, a positive impact, and this was more abroad than in the United States. One was in France. In France, of course, Marie Galbraith, as I mentioned, had been the ambassador's wife. She knew everybody from Chirac down. And there were lots of copies that were sent to France and widely distributed among French VIPs. And I believe that this was one of the seeds, this was one of the important pieces of evidence, of elements, that led to the French creating their own report, which was a similar effort, and that was the Cometa report. The Cometa report, however, was done by a number of generals and admirals and so on, retired, though. It was in that sense, technically, it was not a French government report, because there were people who had been in government, but they were currently retired. And in their report, in fact, they gave credit to our report. They mostly give the accolades to Mrs. Galbraith because, you know, she's the one they knew and all that. That's fine. But our names appear in the bibliography anyway. But so that was one aspect where our report did have an impact and led to the French people or this committee doing their own report. The other place, and I played a role on this, was in Chile. I was going to many trips in Chile at that time because I was invited. There were a number of symposiums put by the University of Santiago and other outfits were put
in. So on the university level down there, they discussed UFOs?
Well, at that time the UFO subject was extremely hot in Chile. Uh-huh. And yes, when they had the symposiums at the University of Santiago, the opening speech was given by the dean of the university. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, the Chilean government, the Chilean Air Force, more than the Air Force, actually, the the Civil Aviation Agency,
okay,
which would be the equivalent to the FAA.
Okay.
But in Chile, as in Brazil and in many countries, the civil aviation is under the Air Force. It deals with civilian airliner business, traffic and so on, but it's still under a general of the Air Force and all that. It's connected to the Air Force. So is the case in Chile, where there has an Air Force general leading it. And at that time, there had been an air traffic controller in Chile called Gustavo Rodriguez, whom I had met a few years previous, who for many years had kept the logs of all the cases in the Chilean airports involving unidentified flying objects being reported by airline pilots. He made sure that these cases would not be erased, that the logs would be kept. Now, there was a former commander-in-chief of the Chilean, and I will mention briefly this in my presentation. There was a former commander-in-chief of the Chilean Air Force called General Ramon Vega, who was also a senator. So a very important man, right? Former commander-in-chief.
Yeah, was he both offices at the same time?
No. Okay. After being commander-in-chief, he had become a senator.
Okay, gotcha.
I met him personally. And he was very interested in UFOs, and he was one of the people instrumental in getting the Chilean government to create this agency under the aegis of the Civil Aviation Agency. And when I met him, is when they were compiling all the necessary documentation, you know,
right,
to convince the government that this was a worthwhile effort. And I gave him a copy of our report, and I'm not claiming that was the only thing. Of course, they had many other elements, but I believe that helped. You know, they could then go to their superiors and say, well, here's a document, you know, that was financed by Rockefeller and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually the Civil Aviation Agency did create a department. It works under the Technical School of Aeronautics, which is where the traffic controllers go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the offices for the UFO department are located.
And they literally have an office.
They literally have an
department.
Office, yes,
right.
And the budget comes through that school. This is an example of things that are happening in South America.
Yeah, things are moving. I want
to
get back to that, but we're going to have to take a break here. This is Jerry Pippin, and we are from the Crash Retrieval Conference, and we'll be right back. But first, I want to talk to you about our sponsor, UFOTV.com. They have a great 3-DVD set out right now that I could not recommend more highly, I guess is what we best say. The Best Evidence DVD is what I'm talking about. Oh, George Knapp, of course, a famous TV reporter and a good friend of ours here in Las Vegas, really did a lot of work on this. Not only does it have the original Knapp documentary, which is really a very special edition, probably the most comprehensive DVD on UFOs ever produced, and I don't say that lightly when I talk about home viewing. This is something that not anybody else has, really, and UFOTV.com has it. It's called Best Evidence. In addition to the documentary, there is a very, very interesting set of interviews with researchers and actually videos and video clips and photos and things that are just not available out on the market. So if you are a UFO person who is very interested in finding out the real facts, I could not recommend anything better than Best Evidence. Here's all you have to do. Call UFOTV.com at 1-800-350-4639. That's 1-800-350-4639. Or simply go to their website, UFOTV.com. This has been a very interesting discussion, Antonio. And are you doing besides lecturing here tomorrow? What's happening with you? You're just doing research on UFOs, or have you got some other thing you're doing?
Obviously I'm doing a few other things that I'm doing for, you know, to make a living, but...
I'm just trying to get you to plug some things.
No. Well, at this point, I'm working on some projects, but it's still a little preliminary to...
I mean, we just did a commercial for a DVD manufacturer. Hey, you may have one here before long. You have a lot of South American clips? Or access to them? Clips of UFOs and things?
Oh, yes, I have, of course.
Yeah.
No, but I don't have anything there on for
sale. I understand that, but you do have a lot of...
Of course, the subject of UFOs is immensely popular in Latin America.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get around to, is the attitude is totally different.
It's
really
totally different. I would say it's certainly in terms in cultural or sociological terms, the culture is much more predisposed. There's much less stigma in the belief in UFOs. The governments now seem to be more open to it. I would say the only part of the South American culture which are pretty close-minded, they're almost worse than the North American counterparts, is the scientific community.
Oh, really?
Yes, the scientific.
I thought you were
going to
say the religious community.
Yeah, no. No, the religious community is not so bad on this subject because the Catholic Church is not. It's pretty open-minded about it's different from the evangelicals in the United States.
Right, right.
You know, I'm sure you know about Monsignor Balducci in Rome.
Yes.
Whom I met, by the way, too. And so the Catholic Church doesn't seem to have they don't have an official position on UFOs, but they don't equate it with the satanic or anything like that as opposed to some evangelicals. I don't say all evangelicals either, but some evangelicals, they seem to equate UFOs with, devilish.
Well, we hear stories of South American, especially in Brazil, of incidents where the ETs are the contact with whatever, they're not necessarily
negative,
friendly.
That is correct. there's all kinds of UFOs, just like there's all kinds of human beings, and there's people have this tendency that...
Obviously, I'm not pushing the demonic angle. I'm just talking about the idea that there are... It's not all goody-two-shoes.
No, you are absolutely correct. Yeah. I think that it's a kind of a trait of human psychology that they tend to, and you find this among many researchers, that on the one hand, there will be some that will tend to believe that everything that UFOs do are sinister. And likewise, there are others that will say that, oh, they're wonderful, the Space Brothers and the contactees
right.
and all that. But if we look at our own race, humans, they're good humans and they're bad humans and they're humans in between.
Right.
And
you've been doing this for 30 years. It appears to me that the ETs have the same traits we do.
Yeah.
Good, bad, and the ugly.
And in between. And in between. But you're absolutely right. In Brazil, and I did write some articles about this years ago in the UFO Universe magazine and also in a column I used to write for the New York City Tribune. I did write about these cases in northern Brazil. And so did Jacques Vallée in his book Confrontations, and Bob Pratt, the late Bob Pratt, was an expert on the Brazilian cases.
Some of those cases...
People were injured and even dead.
Fired upon.
Yes, they were fired by beams. So these were not accidental. The other cases, for instance, in the briefing document, we had a famous case in Canada, the Michalak case.
I don't know about that.
Well, that was a mineral prospector who came to I think it was in 1967. And it happened in Manitoba, I believe. And there was a saucer that had landed, and it was still like buzzing, like emitting a sound. And he came very close. I believe he even touched it. And after that, this man was really sick. He had to be hospitalized and everything. Eventually, he did recover, but he had some kind of radiation sickness.
And of course, there's the famous story.
Cashel Andrum case, yes. And this case was documented by the Canadian Royal Mounted Police. And there's Air Force files and everything. In our briefing document, we discuss it in detail. But I cannot say that case was an aggressive case. It was more like an accident. The guy stumbled into a thing that was emitting, some kind of radiation, and he got injured. But in there are other cases like that, which are perhaps probably accidental. But in the Brazilian cases, there's no way you can say they're accidental. You have these things that they used to call them in Portuguese, the geladeiras, or the ice boxes, because they were rectangular in shape. And they were pursuing these hunters on the Amazon and shooting them with beams.
It was amazing.
But on the other hand, you have cases in Peru and in other places where people have been healed. So I think it's a mixed bag, and it's not a good idea to categorize it, as all, certainly not as all good and or as all bad,
right.
But it's I think we're dealing with a multiplicity of phenomena and entities. They're not all coming from the same place. They have different agendas, different purposes, and they're coming from different locations. That's my take.
I'm inclined to agree with you on that, Antonio. You have an internationalist viewpoint on this, and that's one of the reasons I'm very happy to have you
well,
on the show.
Well, it's a global phenomenon. You know, Americans are so consumed with their own culture and their own, because, you know.
Now he can say that, folks, because he was born in New York.
But the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about UFOs is that they're absolutely a global phenomenon. It doesn't matter the political system or the geographical or the, even the religious. You know, a country like Iran, which right now, you know, we're having all these problems. Yet Iran has a rich history of UFO cases.
Yes, they do. They seem to have more than a lot.
Yeah, we have. We had the famous case of the Phantom, therefore Phantom jet, you know, that was scrambled.
Right,
the classic
scrambled
case.
And
yeah, that was in our briefing document as well. And Turkey, another Islamic country.
I guess the power just went off on that jet, huh?
The weapon system. The man tried to fire it in AIM-9 missile, and the weapon system was jammed.
Did you cover the stories of the jamming of missiles here?
Yes, that was also there, the Strategic Air Command missile. We had that case, and we also had...
Some things in Russia, too.
Yes, we had a case in Russia to the Kapustin Yar incident in 1989, very similar to Ben Waters in England, you know, the classic case. I know you had Peter Robbins previously to me, and he's one of the experts on that case. Very similar, where you had this disc-shaped object shooting a thin beam at the weapon storage area where the nuclear weapons were stored. It's exactly the same thing that Colonel Holt says it happened in Ben Waters. So, and the Russians, of course, have had all kinds of committees, and there was even a case which I wrote. It's not in the briefing document, but I published in a journal called The Anomalist a few years ago, where the codes for the nuclear targets were changed. A UFO was seen over a nuclear intercontinental nuclear missile base in Ukraine, at that time part of the Soviet Union, and it was seen by all the people on the base. The guy that was on the bunker didn't see it because he was on the bunker, but the man that was in control of the weapons control panel, right? But he reported that the codes had been changed. And that could not be done. Could only be done by order from Moscow, directly by direct link from Moscow.
Sure.
And they of course, they appointed a committee. They took the machine apart to see if there was a malfunction. They could never prove
it. It seems to be a pretty rich history of ET intervention in military operations like
Oh,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a case. I met a man who's going to appear in this press conference on Monday. You know that you're having in Washington.
Yes, Washington. Yeah. Are you going to make it back in time?
Unfortunately, I'm here in Vegas, and I'm not going to make it back in time. But my co-author Berliner will be there, and the man from the Peruvian Air Force, one of the colonels from the Peruvian Air Force, going to be there that have the similar department to the one in Chile.
What is he going to say? This show's going to be on Monday. Maybe we scoop him.
Well, I don't know what he's going to say, but I know what he told me.
Okay.
He was present at a famous incident, I believe it was in 1982, and this appears in one of the declassified documents from the U.S. government, but the part I'm going to tell you does not appear there. In the U.S. document appears that a UFO was seen over a base, and that they scrambled a plane, and the pilot, I think, was going to shoot or something. Now, but what the colonel told me is that they had the pilot asked to the commander, said, well, should we shoot at the UFO? Because I guess they were urging him to identify himself, you know, it wasn't whatever. So technically they had to shoot him, right? They didn't know it was flying over a military base and all that. And the commander said, no, don't shoot because those things are too expensive.
That
missile is too expensive, and they probably knew that it's not going to do any good anyway. So they were just going to waste, you know, whatever $5 million or whatever.
They're talking
about
the craft he's flying, not necessarily the UFO being expensive, but. That guy deserves a medal. At least somebody has some logic in the military.
Yeah, they saved some money to the Peruvian Air Force. Anyway, so there's many interesting reports from all over the world, and especially in South America. And we haven't talked yet about my presentation here. You know, I will be discussing a total of 8 cases, but 5 of these cases are cases where you have actual metal fragments, which were analyzed. These are not alleged cases, you know, based on some story that someone told you, as usually is the case with crash retrieval stories, you know, because
yes.
the government is not telling
fourth,
you the truth. Fourth. You have to put the story together, but often you have to base it on anonymous reports
right.
or purported documents or things like that.
So
but there is no metal piece. In these cases...
You have
yes,
piece of evidence.
Well,
huh?
We have the piece of evidence. We have...
What kind, is this a magic metal or a strange metal?
Well, I think that these... they're not technically... I couldn't say that they're a piece of hardware.
Uh-huh.
They seem to be more like a piece of what the ballet called liquid metal. It seems to be almost like a byproduct of the UFO, of the propulsion system of the UFO.
In other words, it
ejects some
uh-huh.
material.
Uh-huh.
And then
it comes out of it.
Well, when people see this happening, because we have the witness testimonies of the people that collected the thing, it looked like a molten metal. But as it eventually cools off,
down.
And then it solidifies.
Had some solid characteristics about it, but not completely solid.
Not yes. Well, once it solidifies, it's a metal
but
piece.
But it's soft.
No, it hardens.
It hardens. Okay.
It hardens.
Okay. I wanted to get this straight in my mind.
Yeah, well, we have two cases from Brazil. One of them is very famous. The first one was famous on its day, but it's kind of forgotten now. It's called the Campinas case. That's from 1954 in Campinas in Sao Paulo State. Then there is Ubatuba. Ubatuba, which is, according to the report, it was a UFO that exploded. But unfortunately, we don't know who the witness was. The witness sent a letter to a newspaper columnist in Rio de Janeiro and with the pieces. So we have...
So you got evidence.
We have the evidence, but no one people couldn't track whoever wrote the letter, you know. There was no return address, or the name was illegible, or whatever the story was. But that piece has been analyzed to death by now. It was analyzed originally in Brazil. Then pieces were sent to the United States, to the old APRO organization. Even the Condon Report analyzed it, although they came up with, they tried to debunk it. And finally, Professor Sturrock, who I mentioned earlier on
yes.
the Rockefeller
mm-hmm.
Report, he had done extensive analysis of them, has been analyzed by French universities, it's probably the most analyzed piece, at least in civilian hands. Then I will be presenting a case from Argentina, which is totally unpublished.
I want to find out a little bit about that one when I come right back, if you don't mind talking a little bit about it.
Yeah, I don't want to go too much into it, because I want to keep a certain mystery about it.
And I want to get back to that older case, too, 54.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but first of all, I've got to pause for this word. And this word, of course, is from our sponsor, UFOTV.com, 1-800-350-4639. Write that number down. You'll see why in a moment when I tell you about their great collection of UFO and conspiracy DVDs. If you'd like to have a color catalog, you can just simply pick up the phone and call and ask them. They'll send it to you, 1-800-350-4639. One of the interesting DVDs they have right now is Life on Mars. Scientists have found artifacts on the surface, high-resolution photos, and basically this DVD was put together by Dr. Tom Van Flanders, and we've talked to him before on the air, so you know what he's all about. And it has all of the documentation of the things you hear about the cylinders, the glass cylinders, and the strange statue, the face on Mars, and things like that. Was there a dense forest there and remains? It presents all the facts in a way that you can make your own mind up. It's a very scientific DVD on a subject that has lots of speculation. I think you'll find it very interesting. That's just one of the many DVDs offered on UFOs and conspiracies at UFOTV.com. And here's that number again to call for the color catalog, 1-800-350-4639. Tell them you heard about it on the Jerry Pippin Show, and maybe they'll send me one. Anyway, a little dig at our sponsors. No. Okay, Antonio, tell me a little bit about your Argentina thing. I know you're saving it for here, but give me a little tease anyway.
Well, basically, this is a case that happened in the Andes Mountains near the border with Chile in February of 1967. And the interesting thing about this case is that it has never been published. really, this presentation I'm giving here in Las Vegas will be the first time that this case gets any attention. I'm not only talking in English; it's never even been published in Latin America. And it was a family who were having a nice picnic there in the mountains. February is summer in South America, Southern Hemisphere.
Right, just the opposite of
the opposite of here. And they suddenly saw this huge disc-shaped object, bigger than an airliner. Rose across a hill near where from where they were, and they said they could see like sparks coming out of the object. Well, also that it was emitting like a very very strong buzzing noise that more than the ears, it would hit your brain. So they were all numbed, this family, right? The main witness, who's the one that is alive now, because the father and mother are passed away since this happened in this 40 years ago, right? He was about 13 years old at that time. So finally the UFO leaves, and they walked into the area where this thing had landed. And everything was charred, everything, you know, they say the rocks, they could pulverize and so on. And then they saw this glistening metal, something called their attention. And basically they got this piece.
In the sunlight or something?
Everything else was blacked and, like, destroyed, and this was the one thing that was...
Yeah,
it was being hit by the sunlight. Mm-hmm. And, well, eventually this piece was analyzed by a number of labs, it's quite an interesting case, and
there'll be more information coming about the conference also later on.
Well, there's the proceedings in the papers too, where there's a little bit more detail about the analysis. But in the PowerPoint presentation, I will be showing some photos of it also, and then there's two more cases there that I have with metals. The other one is better known in to American audiences, especially those who read the book Confrontations by Jacques Vallée. It's known as the Bogota sample. It was again a piece of like a molten metal that was recovered by two students who were at the campus of the University of Bogota around 1975 or 76, and it was eventually given to Vallée, and he had it analyzed, and I will be presenting those results as well. And then finally, in 1993, there was another case in Chile of a mineral prospector called Jorge Tabé, and he was on the mountains in the northern part of Chile when, again, he saw this huge UFO. It describes it like a mothership, rose over the mountain, and again, he could see like sparks coming off. But it was too cold and too late at night, so on the next day he rented some mules. He used to go there prospecting for minerals, right? So he was familiar with the area, and he found these two pieces, and he was eventually samples of the pieces were analyzed by two Japanese laboratories, because this man was of even though he's a Chilean citizen, but he was of Japanese descent, which is unusual in Chile. There are very few people of Japanese origin, but he was one. So, and again, that case, although this case was published in the Chilean press, is not at all well known in the United States.
What about this?
On top of that, we'll be discussing some more traditional UFO crashes where something crashed and there was an investigation and the area was cordoned off and so on.
You know, the thing about these UFO crashes, and I talked to Ryan Wood about this, when he first decided to have a conference like this 5 years ago, I thought, well, you know, how many crashes can there be?
Right.
Well, there's a lot of them.
Well, there's
at least a lot of reports.
Well, there's a lot of reports, but we cannot say for sure that they're all genuine UFOs.
Right.
I believe that some of these cases probably are classified things, you know, which would be similar in the sense that the military would cordon off the area,
sure,
would cover it up, would issue a disinformation campaign. So you have to understand that, especially in the period of the Cold War, most people don't know this. The United States and the Soviet Union had a treaty where they were supposed to return each other's spacecraft.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
And so by treaty, they had to return it. But imagine, if the CIA and these people could get hold of the Soviet spy satellite, would they be willing to reach, you know, to return it?
Yeah, practically.
Of course not.
Right.
So in many instances, they had to just pretend that this thing never happened, right. Come up with cover stories, whatever, so that they would keep it and analyze. So I'm not saying you have to, of course, look at case by case, and then see what are the circumstances.
Now you mentioned a case back in 1954, a little earlier.
Oh, the Campinas case.
Yeah. Yes. And a lot of our listeners are new to UFOs.
Oh, yeah, they would definitely not know about this case. This case, if you look at the old UFO literature, like Flying Saucer Review and things like that, yes, you will find it if you have issues going all the way back to the 50s. But it was, again, another case where several objects reported in the city of Campinas, which is in Sao Paulo state, and this lady saw that there was almost like this shower of molten metal coming down on her backyard, so much that she had to take care of herself. And then she went and she was going to touch it, but it was too hot, so she stayed away from it. She called her neighbor, who happened to be a retired professor, and he seemed like a very reliable man, Professor Nascimento. He came, saw the thing, heard her story, and that's how we know the story from the neighbor.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, once the piece cooled off, they took it to the local newspaper. And then the local newspaper took it to a chemical lab, and it was analyzed in the chemical lab with the technology that was, you know,
available back then.
Of that time, right? And it was determined to be mostly tin. And then it was, because the newspaper basically had it, of course it was published all over the Brazilian press. And then at that moment, once the story was published, then the Brazilian Air Force, who had a UFO official investigation similar to Project Blue Book, they heard it in the newspaper that this had happened, they immediately sent a directive, a cable to the newspaper, and they confiscated the piece. But they even wrote a receipt and everything. And so, unfortunately, that piece was analyzed by civilian labs, but then once it went into the hands of the Air Force, that's it. It disappeared from view. But the other pieces are still in civilian hands. And one of the things that I'm trying to achieve in this conference is, but of course these things take funding, you know. If it would be interesting to reanalyze some of these metals, except the Ubatuba, which has been done recently by qualified scientists. But the others, I mean, not that, for instance, the Pulan case from Argentina was done by very qualified scientists, but back in the 70s, and the technology has greatly improved.
Do you know where these pieces are?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the one in Argentina and the one in Chile are still kept by the owners. Ubatuba is in the hands of...
If you had the wherewithal, you could probably...
Yes. If there was the proper funding, the Bogota piece, Valer...
Do you have a website or something?
Not yet. I hope to be putting one probably soon, but...
There might be somebody out there that wants to help you out on this. The reason I was there, I guess they can write us and we'll get in touch.
They can contact you, I will leave you my email and stuff.
Okay. Our time's almost up. This has been an exciting hour. It's from the international viewpoint, not only just South America, but all over the world. And your Russian research has been very interesting, too.
Yes. I certainly did a lot of Russian research, yes. And there's some metal pieces also from Russian cases. There was a Dalnegorsk case in 1986, which is a fascinating case. I have beautiful slides of the photos and some of the official reports too, and those pieces were very, very bizarre.
There doesn't seem to be a pattern on these things. It seems like this is just a worldwide phenomenon.
It is definitely a worldwide phenomenon. This is what I was mentioning earlier.
It doesn't seem like anybody's partial to any country. I mean, we're talking about ETs here.
No, it comes and goes in waves, you know. So at one time, like Belgium was, you know, in 1989, 1990, 91, Belgium was the big thing. But now you hardly hear of Belgium. I mean, there's still reports, but it's just average. And it changes. Mexico now, everybody's been hearing for the last 10, 15 years. But prior to 1991, Mexico was not a country with a particularly... I mean, it had cases, of course. It's a big country. But it didn't have a particularly important history of UFOs. I mean, it had, but not. And then things changed, and it became much more visible. It kind of goes in waves.
Yeah, and, it doesn't appear they're playing favorites, or
yeah, yeah.
Or maybe you have some evidence that they are.
We don't know why that is, but and nobody's been able to exactly figure it out what that would.
It was your dad. Your dad was at the UN, right?
Yes.
You remember any of those days at the UN? Were people from other countries more interested in ETs and UFOs?
Well, yes. I was lucky, or it was my destiny, or however you want to call it.
Yeah, right.
My very first UFO event that I ever attended was the one official hearing of UFOs at the United Nations. This was back in 1978 when the Prime Minister of Grenada, Sir Eric Gavely, convened.
Yes.
In fact, I lectured about this whole subject at the X conference in Washington, D.C. Recently, because Stephen Bassett asked me to cover that subject in particular. And that's another thing that we have in mind.
The guy from Grenada actually was really opening, and politics got in the way. They pretty well discounted.
He was overthrown, unfortunately. Yeah. He was obsessed almost with UFOs. And they see the way that the UN works, just by the nature of how the UN was created, and because people have written to secretary generals and all that. Even our briefing document was sent to Boutros Ghali, who was the secretary general at the time. But the secretary general does not have the authority to really do anything. Any subject, unless it's a humanitarian emergency or something like that, but any subject has to be brought by a member nation. Doesn't matter. It can be a big member nation or it can be a small one.
Right.
But you have to have, and this can be done during the General Assembly, when all the heads of states come. And this is how Gary did it. He was a tiny country that had 50,000 people or something like that, had just become independent in the 70s, had 5 years of independence or 4 years of independence. But he was a head of state, he was a member of the United Nations, and he could do it. And he did. Unfortunately, after he was overthrown, the thing didn't prosper, and then no one else wanted to touch it since then. But we're looking. We're looking for a country that would be courageous enough. And I think that realistically, it would be more likely to be a small country that has nothing to lose, you know. It's going to be much. Of course, it would be nice to have France or some country like that. But
I've always felt that real disclosure probably come from somewhere else than the United States or Europe.
It almost looks this way. If you even look at this panel of this press conference at the National Press Building on Monday, they have a very impressive array.
Of international
people. And it's practically all international, with exception of James Callahan from Simonton, who's moderating it, and Charles Holt from the Ben Waters case. And even though he's an American, but the case happened in England.
Yes. I've enjoyed it, Antonio.
My pleasure,
pronounce your name again for me.
Antonio Who Knows.
I still think that's Antonio Who Knows.
Well, maybe that could be like the marketing pitch.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And
we'll
stay
pleasure.
In touch, and maybe somebody will be contacting us to want to write you a check on that.
Yes.
Stuff.
So I will give you my...
Okay.
Address and email and all that.
And we want to thank Shanina Johnson for being our on-location producer.
Once again, that was recorded in 2007 at the Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas. That year it was held at the Tuscany Suites Hotel on Flamingo, right down the street from where I used to live, as a matter of fact. We had another interesting guest that year, Peter Robbins. Peter and I have become very good friends over the years, especially even since this interview, since he was involved with the city of Roswell and lining up their speakers. So we worked fairly closely together. Anyway, let's pick up the interview with Peter Robbins. He's talking about various subjects, including UFOs and Madison Avenue.
And one of our friends... In fact, Peter, I hope you don't mind me calling you one of our friends, because
I
really feel like you and I...
You go back a bit now.
Yeah, we've done quite a few conferences together.
We have indeed, yeah.
And of course, this is an interesting subject you're on this time, Peter Robbins. You're talking about advertising and imagery and the movies and all of that. What'd you say about that? I saw while we were getting ready to do the show, you got several compliments by people walking by here.
Well, you know that I'm best known for the work on the Rendlesham Forest case and the book Left of the Escape.
And we have an incredible show where you talk about that. I think we did that one down in Laughlin.
That's right. That's right, about 2 years ago.
Yeah, and people can still call that up.
But in this case, when I spoke with Ryan, our conference organizer, early this year, and he said, what do you want to talk about in November? And I said, you know, Ryan, I haven't decided yet, but I want to do a talk based on something I've never heard a talk done on. And he said, good, you know, let me know when you figure out what that is. And I don't know if you're aware, Jerry, but my background and training is as a painter and a film historian. I taught painting for years. I was a professional painter before I became a writer. And so I'm very visually oriented.
Yeah, I recall it the first time I met you were Bud Hopkins.
Yeah.
He's quite an artist as
and
well.
That's how one of the reasons we connected up 30 years ago, way back when.
I started to say there's probably a connection here.
Yeah. And so I started to think about, you know, every once in a while, for decades now, we see commercials, sometimes in gluts, sometimes, you know, there's a long period, where you have UFOs and aliens in them selling us every damn thing imaginable in the world. They vary wildly from almost homemade ones of little companies selling ice cream to kids to giant multinational tech corporations selling us, you know, sophisticated computer gear and the like. And I know, you know, in this wonderful wide-ranging field, there's all views, and there is a contingent of folks in our field here who feel that such commercials are part of a ongoing covert program to help condition the public to the reality of UFOs and their implications. And in principle, I was open to that, but as always, in doing an investigation, I go in without an agenda, do my best research, and follow the trail, and what I find is what I find.
Well, what did you find? Is there a vast conspiracy, or is it just people saying, hey, this is a hot topic?
Well, I went in looking for conspiratorial material.
Okay.
And what I set as kind of my holy grail was, if I could find one commercial that let something out that had never been in the public record before, and then I was able to establish that when that commercial was made, the CEO of the company was maybe a member of a brain trust or a think tank, and if I could then go on to establish that they had been contracted to do work for the government, I thought this is a long shot. But if I can do it, maybe that would suggest, you know, there is a kind of a darker pattern
here. Did you find something?
I did.
Oh, really?
But it didn't take me where I thought it was going to.
Oh, really?
What I found after going through more than 100 print ads going back over 30 years and dozens of television commercials from half a dozen countries was an ad, a pair of ads made for American television in 1989 by the Levi Strauss Company. They have a division of their company called Dockers that makes more formal trousers. Mm-hmm. And this was right at the beginning of the MTV revolution when the grainy footage and handheld camera and jump cutting were kind of trendy. So it's the camera is firmly focused on kind of the crotch area of a guy in a pair of Dockers, sort of moving around in sort of party atmosphere, a lot of background noise. And the voiceover for the commercial was the same in both commercials. And essentially it goes, hey, did you know America is hosting EBS? And, oh, do you believe in UFOs? Ooh, UFOs. And he says, do you know America's hosting EBS? And the voice off screen says, EBS, what are EBS? He says, EBS are extraterrestrial beings and America's got them. And then the background crowd goes, ooh, EBGB, you know, and it fades out. Well, it got me thinking. The term EBE, E-B-E,
yes,
first came down the pike at us in 1987 with the public release through Stanton Friedman and colleagues of the Eisenhower briefing document, the first seminal MJ-12 document. And it refers to EBEs as these creatures that during the autopsy period, the team around Dr. Detlev Bronk, who was a presidential science advisor, who all the smart money says, if there was a crash, if bodies were recovered, they would have been autopsied, Bronk would have been the man to lead the team. And I found in no less than 15 print sources from the absolutely hairball to the really scholarly, that the team that worked with Bronk is credited with coming up with this term extraterrestrial, hyphenated, mm-hmm. biological entities to describe these critters. And I thought, wow, maybe I've got something here. And then this guy named Bob Haas, who was CEO in 1989 of Levi Strauss.
Levi, right.
He, at the time, was also a member in good standing of the Brookings Institution.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we know that Brookings has been doing papers on the implications of extraterrestrial reality since as early as at least 1960. And I thought, wow, I'm on to something here. I continued the search to see if I could find anything else, and I couldn't. Now, the commercials that I showed and the print ads, and it was about 60 or so that I showed on screen and several dozen, about a dozen television ads from three countries. They were clever. Many of them were well-written. The graphics were sophisticated. The copy was, you know, real Madison Avenue stuff. Some of it was sort of homemade. Some of it was really world-class. And the first thing I did was I broke it down into groups. These are products just selling to children. This is a whole slew of commercials where they rely on the term UFO, but it means something other than unidentified flying object, and it helps sell their product. Then as I really looked, I found commercials that absolutely were about abduction, other commercials that were about back engineering, a few that were about crash retrievals. Thought, this is good.
Now, do you think that's the copywriters and producers of these commercials are just up on our industry here, UFOs?
Well, again, my premise was, are these a manifestation of an organized covert program to help acclimatize us to this? And there are probably such programs going on. Or is it Madison Avenue just knowing that aliens and UFOs sell products and employing it for all it's worth? For example, in 1997, the 50th anniversary of Roswell, you remember, I mean, the world went UFO crazy, and every documentary was reshown. There were all these products for a year or two, a couple dozen extra magazines, and then everybody lost interest for a few years.
Right.
One of the most sophisticated that year was a Absolute Vodka one. You know, the terrific series of ads. It was a vodka bottle reminiscent of a mothership floating over the desert at dusk, and the caption was Absolute Roswell. Anyway.
Yeah.
For
Absolute Vodka.
Yeah. And what I relied on here was my common sense and good human logic. And I put them together in groups to make for a good presentation. I wrote clever descriptions of what we were seeing on screen. But I realized unless I could really make this Levi Strauss thing work or maybe find another one, I didn't know where to go with it. Because number one, Haas may have been an ultimate insider. Who knows? Maybe Brookings or, you know, NSA through there, whomever, said, you know, Mr. Haas, we'd really appreciate your help in the national security thing to do a commercial that mentions this term that nobody's ever heard of outside ufology. Or maybe he just took it upon himself. But I don't consider that proof at all, Jerry. For me, it's interesting. But unless I can back it up, it's just an anomaly. And I realized, you know, I know nothing about Haas. I don't know whether he was introduced to that paper at Brookings. I don't know if he ever read that paper. I don't know if he ever read any paper on UFOs. I don't know if he read a book on them or even had an interest in it. And so I could only push so far on it. But what I was looking for was some thread that was common in all these commercials and pieces of print ad. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I kind of applied a technique that I used to use as a painter, which was you work on something until you almost go into an altered state, and then it takes on a life of its own. The experience of painting becomes more pleasurable and really quite inspiring in itself. And after I had looked at these things logically repeatedly, I just put on my disc. And I looked at them, and I looked at them again. I mean, 60 at a clip, then 20 minutes worth of commercials. And I went till about 3 in the morning, and it hit me. I found the thing they all had in common, every one of them.
Really?
Yes. It was dual kind of concept. Number one,
okay.
Not a single commercial took the subject seriously. They were all, in their own ways, clever, sarcastic, satirical, demeaning, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, as they say in England. Plus, they all had another thing in common. The one thing that they never alluded to, said, or even suggested was that UFOs and aliens and their implications might actually be real. I thought, now, what? How can I evaluate this data in the face of this idea that there's an ongoing program to help integrate it and make us take it seriously? Well, I couldn't, because they weren't. Every one of them was about taking it
silly. Did you take it to the other extreme? Maybe it was designed.
I became devil's advocate and said, maybe there's a program to mock them.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes against the thesis of this is about helping the public to acclimatize to the subject so that when disclosure really happens.
Did you remember those California milk?
I re-showed them. Okay. I re-showed them, and they were a perfect example of clever, funny as hell.
Yes.
And I also showed them...
Well, and the devil of abductions, to a certain extent, cattle mutilations, but they made it funny.
They did it big time. But one of the things that I recalled, and I know you remember it too, was when the California Milk Council, or whatever that acronym was, showed them to us 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It was with great sensitivity and respect, and to find out if anyone in the audience, knowing there'd be abductees and experiencers there, felt this was in any way mean-spirited or mocking.
Yeah.
And, of course, they were just fun from start to finish,
right.
And we all gave them our blessings, and they ran them on TV out west.
Right, but we were the ultimate focus group.
And you remember, they gave us a lot of free drinks that night.
Yes,
and
they
I
were.
Thought that
all,
was not a bad
all
salad.
With milk. I didn't know you could make so many drinks with milk.
Boy, oh boy. I tell you, I was pretty
lacerated
by the end of that one, yeah. You know, you give people too much free alcohol and they'll support you on anything. But ultimately, what I was able to come to as a conclusion was, for most people, the real subject of UFOs and aliens for real is very anxiety-provoking. And when we're looking at UFOs and aliens in commercials, it gives us a chance to do something that real life and the real possibility does not, which is to look at them and think about them, but not have to take them seriously. Now, do I feel that there was any chance, or there is any likelihood, that the government is covertly encouraging this or funding it? I thought, no, I know too much about the advertising industry.
Right.
They're sharp as tacks. They're picking up on every pop culture trend. They see all the movies and, you know, listen to the TV shows we do.
It appears that there may be a crack with the media now that they will take the subject seriously.
Yes.
But up until this time, Madison Avenue is only reflecting what the pop culture is.
That's it. And I think in great part that's what we were seeing, that as long as it's fun, as long as it's teasing, as long as it's playful, yeah, think about UFOs and aliens all you want. But the last thing it does is to help people take it seriously. So I think I might have disappointed some of my more conspiratorial colleagues.
Yeah.
But I think overall, even though it was sort of dry and academic, I think it was a good paper.
Yeah,
and
it
that
certainly
folks
would be for,
valued
for
it for what it was.
Right. You may have a whole new career lecturing advertising.
Oh, God. Actually, that'd be great. They have money. Unlike ufologists. But it was actually very satisfying. Our wonderful audience seemed to like it.
Yeah.
And I had a good time doing it. And we actually, it's the first talk I've ever done in this field in my whole life where I got laugh after laugh because the commercials are funny.
Well,
so,
dark
machinations.
We're
going to
take a commercial break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some things that you've lectured on before that weren't so funny.
Amen.
And some of them are pretty serious.
Yeah.
But you're actually a fun kind of guy, and well, I am too, kind of Pat, but we deal in serious subjects,
Amen.
Too. Peter, we could go on for hours. What have you got going on book-wise? Are you writing anything else?
I'm not working on a book now. I'm working on a number of papers. One that I'm quite excited about that I'll be giving for the first time at the International UFO Congress in Laughlin in February.
Well, good. We'll talk to you about it down there.
Yeah. Well, very quickly, though, what it is something I've wanted to do for years and nobody said do it, which is a lot of stories that never went into print. Funny, scary,
anxiety-provoking, ironic. I'll sit up there and tell you some stories, Jerry.
Good. We're looking forward to it. Peter Robbins, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Janina Johnson was our on-location producer and doing a great job, I must say. And because if I don't say it, she'll cut me off. No, she's doing a great job. This is Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening. Cheers. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com.